back again with the second season of Memory Static.
Second season?
I'm your host. Yes, we're in the middle of the second season.
Oh, I thought this was the third season premiere. My bad.
I did mention that I wanted to do that, but I decided that no.
No, we're second season. Yeah, going strong.
I'm your host, Bailey Moore, and I am so excited to return to our regular format. We have just two more episodes to go to finish out this season, but we've been dramatically delayed by the pandemic. Now, it's been hinted at throughout our Halloween specials, but I'm thrilled to announce officially that this episode's special guest is finally, at long last, the one, the only, Cullen Moore.
Yay! It's me!
And to anybody that's just now joining, Cullen is my brother, and we also collaborate on the music for Memory Static.
This is the first time that I get to write a song for my own episode.
Yes, and for anybody that has never listened to the end of our episodes, we have an original song at the end of every episode inspired by the movie that we cover. We haven't been doing that for the Halloween specials and the mini episodes because it's really difficult, but listen through to the end and there will be a song, supposedly. Do you have any ideas about songs for this yet?
Supposedly. I've been thinking about it, but nothing's really jumped out to me yet. I expect once we watch the movie together, the gears will start turning. You know, I've been putting off watching this, Bailey.
Before we get into the movie that we are watching tonight, tell us a little bit about our music and where we can find you.
Well, my music is under the stage name Plaid Tuxedo. That is a nice fancy suit with an ugly pattern, Plaid Tuxedo. My music is everywhere. So everywhere, on YouTube, Plaid Tuxedo, Instagram, Plaid Tuxedo Music, plaidtuxedo.com has the stuff, good tunes, good vibes, happy music, good music. Also, we will be putting out our original songs for Memory Static soon, and you'll probably also be able to access that through my website, among other sources.
You have one album that's already released.
That's true.
Called Soaring Through the Wind.
Yes.
And you're working on a new one, right?
Yeah. It's called Because You're Awesome. And I'm making it because you, the listener, are awesome. And it'll be out soon.
Yeah, I can't wait to hear it. So what are we going to be watching tonight?
Well, for this return to form for Memory Static, we will be watching Return to Oz.
Return to Oz. I feel like that is one that inevitably was going to happen. I think that it sticks in a lot of people's brains for a very particular reason, but we will get to that. A quick aside before we continue. Because it is important to me to emphasize safety, I want to describe to the listeners how this event is going to function. For our screening party, it is a very limited attendance event in my oversized backyard. Everyone is socially distanced in spaces designated by chalk-drawn squares, and everyone must wear a mask at all times. Instead of passing around a microphone like we normally do, everyone will record individually on their phones and send me the MP3s. Will there be a nightmare of editing ahead for me? For sure. But this is the method that I've worked out to be able to continue the podcast as it's meant to be. If any listeners out there have other solutions that they think would work better, please send them to me at memorystatic@gmail.com. Now, Return to Oz. How old were you when you saw this movie for the first time?
I have no idea, honestly. I must have been at least 11. I'm not really sure, because I've only seen this once, and it really stuck with me. Yeah, I don't remember how old I was.
I would believe this movie would make an impact, even if you only saw it once.
Yeah.
So so the last time you saw it was around 11, so how long has it been since you've seen it?
If that is correct, that would make it 14 years.
14 years, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow, I'm really excited for you to revisit this movie. I think it's going to blow your mind.
Oh, yeah.
Based on that one viewing 14 years ago, can you do your best to give us a synopsis of your recollection of what happens in this movie?
I've been preparing for this. So this movie is a sequel to a little-known cult classic film called The Wizard of Oz. And For those of you who have not seen or heard of it, The Wizard of Oz stars a character named Dorothy Gale, who is not a wizard, and she gets sucked up by a tornado from her black and white hometown of somewhere in Kansas into the strange and colorful land of Oz, and she goes on a journey to meet the Wizard of Oz and get home. So this movie, The Return to Oz, begins after Dorothy has returned from Oz, and her tales of a strange land have gotten her diagnosed as a loon, and the Kansas doctors do some, like, electroshock therapy or something to convince her that Oz was a fantasy or a fever dream or something, but it doesn't work, and somehow she gets transported back to Oz. She returns to Oz, but it's not quite the Technicolor paradise she remembers. There's this evil lady with a whole bunch of faces, and she's like, "You'll never stop me, Dorothy! I have your friend the Scarecrow taken hostage!" And then the Scarecrow gets teleported to Dorothy, and he's like, "Dorothy!" And then he gets teleported away, and then Dorothy's like, "Wait a second, that wasn't Ray Bolger, that was just some weird puppet." And then she has to cross a desert that's like the dryness equivalent of the Bog of Eternal Stench, and she meets a wind-up automaton. And there's these creatures who have wheels instead of feet, and the whole thing is just a way different vibe from the original Wizard of Oz. There's not nearly as much color, and that's the main thing that I remember. I think that's probably the most striking thing about the movie, is that the original Wizard of Oz is iconic for how it used the novelty of Technicolor.
You mean the little-known cult film?
Yeah, the little-known cult film. You know, you guys should really check it out. It's pretty good. But, like, in The Wizard of Oz, everything is hyper-saturated. But in Return to Oz, the whole world is so much more subdued in its color. Like, you can really feel the turmoil that's being caused by this witch. Is she a witch? I don't remember.
So her name is Princess Mombi.
Princess Mombi.
Mm-hmm.
So she's like a mom zombie.
But she's sort of a witch, yeah. She's like the Wicked Witch of the West, sort of. But she doesn't have a cardinal direction.
Mm-hmm.
So why did you choose this movie out of all the movies you watched when you were little?
Well, because I don't know. It's just like after just that one viewing, I remember almost nothing about the actual plot of the movie. But there are scenes and images which are just vividly burned into my memory, and I'm really interested to see what it is that I have forgotten, because it feels like I only remember like 15% of the picture.
You had told me before that when you saw The Wizard of Oz, you really loved it, and your favorite character was the Scarecrow.
Yeah.
How did you feel watching this one?
Well, I mean, I was a kid, and, you know, kids don't like change. And the Scarecrow in this movie is not the Scarecrow from the first movie. And I was confused and a little mad, but I mean, in retrospect, like, I can see that this film is trying to go against the formula established by the first movie. But it still kind of has some elements of that formula. And, like, the Scarecrow is... and I could be mistaken about this, but I think that that's the only character from Oz that returns from the first movie to the second and actually gets, like, screen time. But it's not the same Scarecrow. At least it doesn't seem like to me. And I know it's, like, a different studio, different era, but it felt weird that the Scarecrow in this movie is a puppet instead of a person dressed as a Scarecrow. And also it felt weird to me that he's only in, like, two scenes.
Because he's the King of Oz.
I guess so.
That's how they leave it in Wizard of Oz. They make him the King of Oz.
Really? Man, I guess I need to go back and rewatch the cult classic, too.
Yeah, maybe you do. So, did you ever, because of a natural disaster, like a tornado or a flash flood, stumble into a different world?
Well...
I was just kidding. That wasn't my real question.
Okay.
Did you ever daydream about traveling to a different world?
So, Short answer is no, I don't think so. Long answer is I did have daydreams that I was from another world, but not traveling to one.
Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, when I was a kid, there was this kind of fantasy, and this was something that like got tossed around the playground sometimes between me and a few other kids, of being like these aliens from other planets that had these superpowers and stuff. Like, I was an ice wizard from Pluto, because Pluto was a planet at the time. But that was a long time ago. I don't remember very many details.
What scared you the most about this movie?
The faces.
Mombi's faces?
The room full of faces on the mannequin heads. I don't really remember anything about the scene except for that image and it just being so creepy.
You know, I am so excited for you to watch this movie because your impressions of the movie are different somewhat than what actually happens in the movie. And I'm sure that people that have seen this understand what I'm saying, how it actually differs from the way you're describing it. I'm really excited to see those two perspectives, your adult perspective and your child perspective, kind of mash into one another.
Me too. And actually, I'd like to adjust my answer.
Okay.
Because that was the scene that like creeped me out the most.
Mm-hmm.
But the part of the movie that made me feel the most uncomfortable is actually the beginning, when Dorothy is like going into the doctor's place to be, you know, treated for her condition, and like nobody is listening to her. Everyone just assumes that she is insane, and it's just like this suffocating feeling of isolation that you get from that character. I had a very strong emotional reaction to that scene.
You know, I don't blame you, and we'll revisit that after the movie, because I also find the beginning very disturbing. And I also want to say, just because I mentioned this in the Hook episode, I love good exposition. And I feel like this movie, along with Hook, has some of the best exposition in a movie that I've seen. Mm. There's just so much great and buildup of anticipation of what's going to happen, and there is so much foreshadowing. So when you watch it, or when we step out of the time machine and you converge again with yourself and remember the movie and the conversation that we're going to be having, see if you notice all of the foreshadowing.
I'll be paying close attention.
Okay, so it is about time to step into the slow-moving time machine.
Oh boy, I'm so excited.
Yeah, and for anyone at home that would like to join the party and watch the movie, it is available on Disney Plus and for rent on a few other streaming platforms.
Whoa, how convenient.
Yeah. Okay, Cullen. Now I want you to look around the room.
Whoa.
Do you happen to notice a new door that's not supposed to be there?
There is a new door that's not supposed to be there. I see that.
Okay. I just want to clarify that is not a door to Oz, but it is still sort of a door to a different dimension. A pocket dimension, if you will, that moves slightly faster through time than our normal mode of being.
I see.
It is a door to the slow-moving time machine. I've been so excited to break this news to you.
Wait, so you can, like, do remote portals now with your slow-moving time machine? Does it have, like, slow-moving space elements now?
Well, so anybody that's listening that's confused, I'm not going to lie to you and pretend that we aren't conducting our interview through Zoom right now. But it left me with the challenge of how I could still use the time machine, because that's a huge part of the show. And it required some creative thinking on my part. So to answer your question, Cullen, it couldn't function the same way while the pandemic is happening, obviously. So I have reconfigured its manifestation properties so that it's no longer anchored to a certain place.
Wow.
Well, at least the door isn't. So actually, there's two doors. So one door is not anchored to a certain place. That is the door that you see in your room right now. Also, can you see the door behind me?
I do see the door behind you.
So this is yet untested, but if my theory proves correct, I'll walk through my door, you'll walk through your door, and we'll both meet within the control room of the slow-moving time machine.
That sounds exciting.
Are you ready?
As I'll ever be.
Okay, let's go.
All time machine systems online. Systems go.
Okay, so here we are in the time machine. I'm sure you noticed that there's a few different things.
Yeah, I don't remember these buttons in particular.
Yeah, well, there's some new control features now because it's not anchored to a specific place, you know?
I like what you did with the Chrome as well.
Oh, thank you. I thought I would do a little bit of renovating while I was at it. Aesthetic renovating.
Yeah, of course.
For any new listeners, Cullen, can you briefly explain where we are right now and what its function is?
We are inside the slow-moving time machine, which is a device which splits your being in twain so that one half of you may watch a classic film while the other half of you discusses the history of the film and stuff.
Yes. And then once we exit the slow-moving time machine, we rejoin our second half. There's a little bit of disorientation, but you have a dual memories of both watching the movie and talking about it in the slow-moving time machine. And that's where the disorientation comes in. But it's only mild and it only lasts a moment.
And you've worked out that kink that happened that one time Kate came on the show, right?
Well, do you only feel like you're only half of yourself physically?
Well, let's see. I've got my right side and my left side, so I think I'm good.
Right. Okay, good. Then I did work that out. That was really strange. That had never happened before. I don't know why it happened that time, but I did fidget with some stuff. So it took some time tinkering with all the sciencey gadgets and doodads, but I did remodel the slow-moving time machine, like I said, not only aesthetically, but to be pandemic safe. One, it is larger, so we remain socially distanced. Two, there is a screen of time machine plexiglass between us. You may not have noticed it because it is a special kind of plexiglass that is very, very transparent. And it doesn't smudge, yeah.
Wow, it's so clean.
And then finally, I've installed UV lights to help kill any virus bits. You did get the memo about sunscreen and sunglasses.
Oh, no. Oh, it's starting to sting a little bit.
Okay, well, luckily I packed some, so.
Okay, just slide it through that little cellophane slot.
Wait, let me wash my hands first.
Okay, of course. Take your time.
And now that we're in here, I forgot to mention before that there is a slight possibility that because we are no longer permanently anchored to a specific place, that when the time machine slows down to normal time speed to join the party in my backyard, that we might not end up in the backyard at all. We could conceivably end up anywhere. But I'm pretty sure we'll be fine.
You mean like in Oz?
Anywhere means anywhere. I don't know exactly. But I have all sorts of colorful charts displayed, as you can see, that show the probability of that actually happening is pretty, pretty low.
They are colorful charts.
Yes, they are there for your reference in case you start to get uneasy. All right, so Return to Oz, which came out in 1986, directed by Walter Murch, and held the Guinness World Record as the sequel that was made the longest period of time after the original. Until, of course, Bambi the Great Prince of the Forest beat it in 2006.
Oh, man. 'Cause Bambi needed a sequel.
I know, right? So before we get to the history of the movie and how it was made, I want to go over the cast and alternate casting. This movie is starring, as Dorothy, Firouzja Balk. I don't know if you recognize her. She's been in many movies.
It sounds a lot like Veruca Salt.
I had not thought about that, but yeah, it does. This was her feature film debut. And it's interesting to note that she did all of her own stunts in this movie. So
wow.
Kudos, Firouzja Balk. They auditioned thousands of girls worldwide for this role, and she's the one that was cast. Others that were considered included Juliette Lewis from Natural Born Killers, Elizabeth Berkley, who played Jesse Spano in Saved by the Bell, Alanis Morissette.
Really?
Yeah. And Drew Barrymore.
Man, to land your debut as Dorothy Gale and beat Drew Barrymore.
I know, because so E.T. came out in 1982. So this movie came out in 1986. So she had already started her career. Okay. You mentioned earlier how there are some elements that they kind of borrowed from the MGM 1939 classic Wizard of Oz.
Cult classic.
Cult classic. That's right. 1939 cult classic Wizard of Oz and pulled them into Return to Oz.
Yeah.
One of those things is that they have a couple people that are cast in two roles. One in Kansas and one in Oz.
Right.
Do you remember some of the characters that might have been doubled by an actor?
No, I have no idea. I would assume, just based on my gut instinct, that Dorothy's mom is the evil princess.
She doesn't live with her mom, she lives with her aunt.
That one then.
And no, she's not.
No? Oh, well.
No. Okay, so this is going to be a little bit of a spoiler for you, but it's going to be impossible not to spoil a few things in the time machine.
That's okay.
But good news is that half of you is out there watching the movie and not having it spoiled, so.
So I'm only going to get half spoiled.
Exactly. So one of those roles is the Gnome King and the Doctor.
Whoa, I forgot about the Gnome King.
And some of the people that had been considered for that role were Christopher Lloyd and Tim Curry.
What? They didn't pick Tim Curry?
Right? I mean, either of those would have been a completely different interpretation of the role.
Yeah, for sure.
Unfortunately, I haven't worked the time machine to go into alternate realities.
Yet,
exactly. So another one of those roles that an actor played too was Princess Mombi. So you were half right there. But the person in Kansas that she plays is the head nurse at that facility.
Yeah, okay.
And she is played by Jean Marsh, who I had not made the connection until this most recent watch through, but I thought she looks so much like the evil sorceress queen in Willow. And sure enough, it is the same person.
I haven't seen Willow.
You should see Willow. It's really good. I'm surprised that we never made you watch that. So a few of the other people that were considered for Princess Mombi was Louise Fletcher, who was Nurse Ratched in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which makes a lot of sense. And then we have Terry Garr, who is Ingrid in Young Frankenstein. And she was also in our podcast, the people that we've covered, she was also in Mother Goose Rock and Rhyme as Jill.
Oh, I see.
So it's kind of hard for me to imagine her in this role because I see her as being really funny.
She's so silly.
Maybe that was a direction to go of making Mombi silly, but considering the full tone of it, not to say she couldn't do it, I just have a hard time imagining it. And then the other person is Mary Steenburgen, who is in Back to the Future 3.
Mm.
And that's the thing that comes off the top of my head, but she's been in a lot of stuff too.
That's another one that I haven't seen in a while.
She also would have brought a completely different energy to it. Yeah. So Auntie M, or Dorothy's mom, is played by Piper Laurie, which I didn't realize until this watch through that she is Catherine in Twin Peaks. Have you watched Twin Peaks?
No, sorry.
Oh my gosh, you've got to see Twin Peaks, Colin. Just a few more casting notes and then we're going to move on. The character of Jack Pumpkinhead was voiced by Brian Henson.
Jack Pumpkinhead, I forgot about him too.
Yeah.
See, this is what I was talking about. Like, I know that there's so much to this movie that I just don't remember. I guess I'm in the process of remembering it now in the other half of me, but yeah.
But Brian Henson is Jim Henson's son, and the puppetry was done by Jim Henson Studios.
Really?
Yeah. And I didn't realize that. So it's been really great researching this movie. I have even more of an appreciation for it now. But the other person that might have been cast as the voice of Jack was Dick Van Dyke.
Wow.
And Brian Henson did a lovely job. I love him as Jack, but there will always be a part of me that wishes Dick Van Dyke had done this because I will say officially on this podcast for the first time, I love Dick Van Dyke and nothing will ever change that. He's just so precious. Can you imagine? Well, you don't even remember who Pumpkinhead is, really.
Nope. I mean, I know that, like, in the formula of the movie, he kind of fills the same role as the Scarecrow did in the first film.
Yes.
That's basically all that I remember.
Instead of not having a brain, he is only a day old, so he knows nothing.
Ah, yeah. Yep. And then we have the automaton who fills the role of the Tin Man. And I'm assuming there's some third character she encounters at some point, but I don't remember.
We're not going to talk about that one, so I'll let that one be a surprise.
Oh, boy.
One more casting choice that might have been, and I love this too, is that they almost had Don Knotts voice Bellina the Chicken.
What?
Wouldn't that have been great?
Yeah.
I mean, that chicken voice is pretty incredible. I mean, you don't remember it yet, but it is. It sounds very chicken-like.
Well, I feel like I'm remembering it as we speak, and I concur that it is very much like a chicken.
Dorothy! Okay, so the story that I've organized to tell about Return to Oz actually begins early on in Walt Disney's career. He was always attracted to Oz, and it appealed to him because it is considered the first American fantasy book for children. He asked his brother Roy Disney to look into acquiring the rights, but MGM had only just purchased them for what would become the 1939 cult classic. They missed it just by a hair.
By that much.
Ironically, it was Disney's success with a silly symphony short. I don't know if you've ever seen this one. It's the Three Little Pigs. Who's afraid of the big bad wolf? The big bad wolf? The big bad wolf?
That is ringing a bell.
It was incredibly successful for adult and children audiences. So that is what instigated Samuel Goldwyn's interest in making a fantasy film for a mixed audience. However, Goldwyn put the project on the back burner when a live-action Alice in Wonderland film produced by Paramount was, in all accounts, considered a huge financial disaster. So that project would have probably stayed on the back burner until, once again, they were spurred into action by the massive success of yet another Disney film, Snow White and the Seven Dwarves. So MGM felt confident enough by that example to continue with production on Wizard of Oz. Mm-hmm. Many years later, in 1954, Disney bought the rights to adapt the remainder of L. Frank Baum's work. The plan was to adapt it into their first live-action musical for his anthology TV series, Walt Disney's Disneyland. This anthology series is one of the longest-running TV programs of all time, and of course went through many name changes, including Walt Disney Presents, The Wonderful World of Color, The Wonderful World of Disney, Disney's Wonderful World, Walt Disney, The Disney Sunday Movie, The Magical World of Disney, and finally back to The Wonderful World of Disney, as it continues to this day. The series was originally conceived to promote and fund the Disneyland theme park. If any listeners remember, we mentioned this TV program before as Mr. Boogity and Bride of Boogity first appeared as episodes of this series. So, back to Dorothy. Disney's original stab at adapting the material started in 1957, when they began production on what was meant to be a two-part television special called The Rainbow Road to Oz. It was meant to star members of the original Mickey Mouse Club, and they even showed clips of choreographed musical numbers of the original tunes for the film on Walt Disney's Disneyland to tease the movie. Now, if you're curious about that, these segments and a good 10-minute documentary about Disney's pursuit of Oz is available on YouTube. So if you're curious about The Rainbow Road to Oz, check it out. Unfortunately, it was never completed, as Disney diverted his attention to an adaptation of Babes in Toyland, which ended up as Disney's official first live-action musical. It's theorized that the reason the project was abandoned and why The Rainbow Road to Oz was never made is because of the tremendous pressure to live up to the original with Judy Garland. It was still very popular and broadcast regularly on television.
Yeah, the cult was huge for a while.
Yeah, the cult was and has remained enormous. Regarding that, Disney, in his mind, didn't want to have to stand up to the inevitable comparisons, which makes sense. So again, we're going to fast forward to the 80s. the Disney rights to adapt the Oz material were coming up on their expiration date. Not knowing this, respected film editor and sound designer Walter Murch approached the then production chief Tom Wilhite about an idea of making an Oz film. To Wilhite, it seemed like perfect timing and enthusiastically greenlit the project with Murch signed on to direct. And this would be Walter Murch's directorial debut. Return to Oz is a combination of two Frank L. Baum books, The Marvelous Land of Oz and Ozma of Oz. I don't know, have you read any of the books?
No, I mean, I knew there were books. I didn't realize this was two books in one movie.
The Oz series has several books. I didn't actually look up the number. I have a few of them that I bought at Half Price Books several years ago, and I tried reading through some of them, and a lot of them that I tried to read, I can't remember which ones I tried to read, but they were very formulaic. Dorothy goes to Oz, she meets one person, she meets two persons, she meets three new friends, and they become her companions on this journey to this one place, and then she goes back to Kansas. Ozma of Oz, however, was different, and I did enjoy Ozma of Oz. I definitely read the first one, maybe read the second, Ozma of Oz. The rest, I'm just not certain. Sometime within the first 5 weeks of production on Return to Oz, there was a massive regime change, and because of concerns regarding the film going over budget and over schedule, Walter Murch was fired. However, his friends, Steven Spielberg, George Lucas, and Francis Ford Coppola, with all their Hollywood clout, convinced Disney to rehire Murch, with George Lucas promising to step in as director if there were any more problems. It's nice to have good friends.
Yeah, what a power play.
But there were massive budget cuts. And because of that, there were a few significant changes that occurred in the film. Firstly, and I think that you will appreciate this based on what you remember your experience was watching this movie, the original trio, the Lion, the Tin Man, and of course the Scarecrow, had originally been planned to have more prominent roles in the movie. But because of the budget cuts, they were reduced to mere cameos. And there was also a plan to make the Scarecrow's face a more intricate animatronic situation. But they had to ditch that idea for the static expressions that appear in the film. Finally, there had been many locations scouted out that were thought to resemble Oz, but because of the budget cuts, almost everything was shot on sound stages. Side note warning. MGM had nothing to do with Return to Oz, but Disney did have to pay MGM to use the ruby slippers, as they were MGM's intellectual property.
What? Oh, that's...
Did you know that Dorothy's slippers were not originally red?
I didn't. So that's an element that isn't in the original book,
mm-mm.
Which means that it's MGM's original IP.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, that's fascinating. So Disney could still use Dorothy Gale because MGM only had the rights to that one story with Dorothy Gale, but they couldn't use the slippers because the... Wow.
Yeah, ask me what color the slippers were.
What color were the slippers, Bailey? Were they emerald?
No, they were silver.
Silver slippers?
They're originally silver. And the reason why they were changed to red, can you guess?
Yes, I can, because red shows up better in Technicolor.
Yes, they wanted to really take advantage of the full spectrum of Technicolor. And silver was just not exciting.
It's just great.
Red, however,
oh yeah,
pops.
And those shoes do pop. For those of you who haven't seen the cult classic 1939, The Wizard of Oz, just watching those red shoes sparkle alone is enough to give that film a shot.
Back to Return to Oz. The studio had very little faith in the film and did very little to promote it. It did poorly at the box office and got mixed reviews from critics who praised the acting and visual effects, but ultimately disliked the dark tone, which I feel happened a lot in the 80s.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is kind of what I was talking about earlier. Is like the tone is just so different from the original movie. And I feel like a lot of people, that leaves them with a bad taste in their mouth because they, when they think Oz, this isn't the Oz that they think of.
Right. Well, I think that exactly what Walt Disney was worried about with the Rainbow Road to Oz is kind of what happened with this movie. People were going expecting a real sequel. And this was this was not really intended to be a direct sequel to the first movie. It was just going to be like jumping into one of the other stories, or two of the other stories. So this was supposed to be Walter Murch's opportunity to break out as a director. But because of how poorly the film was received, it nipped that trajectory of his career in the bud. He is an award-winning editor and sound designer multiple times over, but this is the only movie that he ever directed. And I think it's such a shame because he obviously has a tremendous creative brain and he brought in a lot of different elements, including puppetry and clay animation. Regarding clay animation, he encountered a lot of doubts about how effective it would be. But he was confident in his belief that it would work, and he was right. It's incredible. I don't know if you can remember it, but the faces on the rocks are one of my favorite parts of the movie.
Oh, the rock faces. Whoa. I remembered that as soon as you said it.
Yeah. I loved the fact that the gnomes could travel from rock to rock. You know, just any rock, suddenly there is a spy there watching your every move. It's so creepy. I love it. Mm. But a note on that, on the clay animation, Will Vinton did the clay animation sequences with the gnomes. And Claymation was the name of his company. And probably the most familiar of his creations are the California Raisins. And honestly, I would really like to do a whole series on Will Vinton because his stuff is really, really cool. And I had never noticed his involvement in Return to Oz before, but I'm really glad that he was a part of it, or his studio was a part of it. And then I wanted to find something on the Wheelers because you didn't mention this as one of the things that scared you the most, but for a lot of people, the Wheelers were pure nightmare fuel. And I really wanted to find something about how they were conceived and like the costuming and the way the actors manipulated the wheels, because it seems so strange and uncomfortable and they would have to learn how to do that. But I couldn't find anything. There's supposed to be a documentary that's coming out, I think, later this month or in December. And maybe that's going to answer a lot of my questions, but it's just not available to me right now. So, unfortunately, I have nothing on the Wheelers. But the final thing that I wanted to mention is I kind of got into a bit of an internet hole doing the research for this. And I learned that this was actually the third attempt at a sequel to The Wizard of Oz. There was one in 1969 called The Wonderful Land of Oz, and the second was an animated feature called Journey Back to Oz in 1972. Now, I haven't gotten to Journey Back to Oz, but I did watch most of The Wonderful Land of Oz, and it is...
It's good.
Right. I mean, it's like, it's so earnest, and because, you know, in that earnestness, it is so much fun, at least for me. Like, those kind of things are not for everybody, because it is some not great television. But if you go through to about 13 minutes and 30 seconds, it sets up this song, because there are five or six songs in this movie that were written originally for this television special. And this one in particular has been stuck in my head because it is so funny to me. There's a little boy, and he sings this song called I Don't Want to Be a Statue, because Witch Mombi is threatening to turn him into a statue because he is not doing his chores and playing pranks instead. So he sings this song, you know, looking up into space going, I don't want to be a statue in someone's flower bed. Who wants people staring at you with pigeons on your head? I want to run and dance and sing. I want to go adventuring. I want to be a real, real boy.
Oh, wow. They really reached for that rhyme, huh?
And like the kid is so charming, and the way that he's singing off key the entire time, it is just so chef's kiss, you know.
Well, I have one song idea for the end of this episode now.
Great. All right. Well, that's all I have. Do you have any final thoughts before we join the party?
Do I have any final thoughts? No. I don't know. I'm just really drawing a blank with this whole movie. I'm excited to see it. That's all I really have to say.
Okay, well, you see that button that's on your side over there?
The red one?
Yeah, I can't get into your space. You press that, and theoretically, we will arrive at the party.
Okay. Pressing the red button in 3, 2, 1.
All time machine systems a facial error. The process you are looking for is not available at this time.
Before we get to the party, Cullen had a rare and adverse reaction to the effects of the time machine. The disorientation lingered well after the normal 5 minutes, and he was unable to complete the group interview with everyone else. We recorded a debriefing a couple days later, and it will be inserted at the end right before the group sign-off. Now, without further ado, we'll pick up right after Cullen and I exited the time machine and into my backyard. All right, here we are at the Memory Static party for Return to Oz. We have very limited attendance, so we're all very spread far apart, but can I get your reaction? Great. So, Cullen, the time machine worked. How are you feeling? We did end up back here.
You know, I am feeling like half of me and the other half of me have joined.
So, what was your experience watching this movie again?
Well, it was good. I can say that, like, there was a lot that I was missing in my recollection of this movie. That I can you come back to me later? I'm still processing everything that I've just seen.
There was a lot to watch.
We'll check in with you at the very end.
Okay.
Okay. Well, let's open it up to everybody else. Who's seen this movie before? Okay, Ilya and Jeremy, what do you remember the most from watching this when you were little?
Okay, so I had a vague memory of this movie, and I thought it was a dream that I'd had, but it was so real that I was like, there's no way this is a dream. But everyone I talked to was like, I have no idea what you're talking about. And I vividly remember the moose, and I thought it was a bed that they were on, but it was actually two couches watching it again. And I remember being really creeped out by the movie. I vividly remember all of the witches' faces and just being like, oh my gosh, she's gonna steal my face. And the Wheelers are definitely a strong memory of mine with the sand. And it's funny because I remember it being so much creepier than it is now, which probably makes sense because I was a child and imagination and all the things that go with it. It was just like, this is creepy. And finally, as I got older, someone's like, oh yeah, that's the movie. And I was like, thank you. Gosh, I thought I was going crazy. Like, this was really intense, you know? And I don't know, it's cool to revisit because I haven't seen it since I was little. And I was really excited that this was the movie we were watching tonight.
Jeremy?
Oh my God. The first thing that I remember was the Wheelers. The Wheelers stood out more than anything else, and that was because this horrifying masks that just had these fantastic curves and amazing angles that added to this sense of curiosity and terror that really stood out more than anything else in the film. The film itself was fantastic. The Gnome King was fantastic. But the only thing that I remember over the two individual watches that I've seen previously to this one was the Wheelers. Just the weirdness, the uncomfortability of those creatures.
Okay, so you caught me on the spot the first time around, but I am prepared to give my actual reception to the movie now. So...
Take a breath.
Nolan, are you recording?
I am. I am, and it's not a good recording. Okay, wait, so what exactly is the question?
Whole conversation about that already.
Okay, I don't need your sass, Bailey.
Sounds like you might.
I might need your sass, Bailey. What I can say is that my recollection of this movie before seeing it again was flawed at best. It has a lot of things in it that are interesting. Terrifying? Interesting? Yes. This movie, I think, is good. I think this is a good movie.
Can I speak to Colin?
So, Kate has requested to talk on my behalf.
Because it seems necessary. This movie seeped into Cullen's subconscious, and he didn't know that a doodle that he drew in an art class that he named Mr. Time Guy very closely resembles TikTok.
That's true. It is almost identical in concept. But that's really more of a detail than a general reception of the movie, which I, again, should state is positive. I think that this is a good movie from the 80s. And if you like 80s movies, it's a good movie. That's all I have to say.
We're going to open it up to everybody else.
Please do.
Those of you that have never seen this movie before, what was the most disturbing part of the movie for you as an adult?
The most terrifying part of the movie. I'm going to have to go with the headless woman waking up to all of her heads screaming, and Dorothy running through a mirrored hallway as heads scream at her from all directions. That seems pretty terrifying. And, you know, the Wheelers are terrifying in their energy, but that was terrifying on its own. Like, that could have been a vignette in a horror series.
I agree. I thought the screaming heads and Mombi waking up without her head and then all of the heads screaming and her smashing glass was definitely the most terrifying thing. Next to the Gnome King's eyes, specifically his eyes, as he got more and more human, they were very red-rimmed, like much so like an alcoholic who's just woken up, like, and is gonna do something erratic. And he has a lot of power and he's wearing ruby slippers. So... that, and then the hands, the hand cave that he could summon to send people into his ornament room. I thought the hands folding in on themselves over and over again was also quite terrifying.
I just realized, so he said it once that the more people who forgot about Oz, the more human he would become. And I thought they were just budgeting their claymation and only doing it sometimes. But now that you say that, it definitely lined up with how many of Dorothy's friends were turned into ornaments.
I thought there was a lot of cool kind of very, very creepy concepts in there, like the hand cave and the heads and all those things. But as an adult, I think the thing that disturbed me the most was the scarecrow puppet and the pumpkin puppet. Something about them was really like, it didn't seem to fit with the rest of the movie, how simple those two were. And every time they came on screen, I felt my gut kind of tighten up. I thought that was interesting. Not so much conceptually disturbing, but definitely visually, it made me very uncomfortable.
Two of the things that I find the most frightening as an adult, one, where the doctor is describing the machine that's going to electrocompulsive therapy, is that what it's called?
Yeah.
Dorothy Gale. And is pointing out how friendly it is and saying, look at this face and here's its tongue. Ho, 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 isn't it cute? That is really freaky to me. And also, when they bring the Gump to life, And he's like, what am I? Why am I here? And she's like, you're just a thing that we put together and brought to life to help us escape. That's it. You know, like, that's really cruel. And like, those are the things that kind of freak me out the most in this movie now.
Yeah, it is cruel because there was a point where he said, I think I preferred my life before. And I was like, oh, no wonder. You had a body and free will.
I didn't remember the beginning at all. And I think the part of the whole movie that freaked me out the most, watching it again and not really remembering everything, was like trying to hook her up to that electric machine during a light storm. Yo, this is probably the worst idea you could probably ever have, like using this electrical machine on this little girl during the middle of a lightning storm. You're gonna, like, something bad is about to happen. And obviously that didn't happen, but all I could think about is like her getting fried to a crisp.
As someone who has just watched the movie for the first time, I have a theory about that. I think that they did start the electroshock therapy, or they left and then lightning struck it. And that whole sequence that followed was her resolving her issues with Oz. And then that really bright light at the end reminded me of a, like, electrical storm. And then she wakes up. Well, I guess she wakes up outside. So my theory has holes.
Alex and Allison?
I actually had Ozma of Oz, like an old school hardcover. And I read several of the Oz books as a kid, but Ozma was the one I owned and like revisited the most often. And just to like bounce on the commentary on how scary the head removal conceit was. In the book, it's very explicit that she picks heads at will, that she has, you know, different heads for different moods and different flights of fancy. And there was something kind of very chilling about her looking at Dorothy and giving her this breakdown of like, you're never going to be beautiful, but I have a very specific purpose for your aesthetic, because that is completely how she interacts with the other heads, is like, I'm going to give a very partial validity to this if I have a purpose for it. It's very dehumanizing, so very, I don't know, dissociative. You saw some pretty warped relations to femininity, I thought, from the princess. It made sense that everyone to her was just a source of aesthetic and a source of communicative tool. It's super psychological for an Oz book, actually, between the Gnome King turning people into things and the evil princess turning people into things. There's a lot going on there. The sequence when she's going through the ornaments is actually much longer in the book, and she's kind of recovering different people. The conceit whereby the Emerald City denizens were green was just one of the elements. There were also, you know, like different figures were identified as gold and different figures were identified as purple, and some of them had like symbolic implications. I believe, if I'm remembering correctly, it's been a long time, but there was one character that the Gnome King specifically made into a very elegant, very beautiful figure as a cruel joke, because the Gnome King thought of that character as so ugly.
Here comes a joke at Bailey's expense. Hey, Bailey, you showed us this movie and it revealed your darkest secret. You're actually a gnome.
How so?
You're allergic to chicken eggs.
Raucous laughter.
Question 3.
And scene. That was second.
If you had the powder of life, what would you sprinkle it on?
I was thinking about this one, and the first thing I thought of was my very comfortable beanbag, because it would be nice to have someone to talk about being a beanbag. And maybe it could tell me, like, the best way to keep it fluffy. I think we could have a really good relationship.
I don't know. I feel like that's, like, a dangerous slope to go down, right? Like, the thing that you sit on, you probably fart in and, like, knows your darkest secrets come to life. I don't know.
But imagine that the thing that you fart in lives for your farts.
Oh, that's worse.
Okay, so you're taking a risk, right? You're like, maybe this thing loves my farts and I'm going to bring it back to life and we're going to be the best of pals.
Does the beanbag chair have a nose? Can it smell is the question.
I think with this it would be like absorbed into the beans. You know?
The thing is, you're bringing this thing to life. You don't dictate how it experiences life.
I was imagining just like a beanbag, and then where the seam would be is a mouth, and that's it.
Can we back all the way up pre-flatulence? that was almost an interesting idea.
Yeah, can we repeat the question?
Okay, it's funny that you went beanbag, because I was only thinking about things in my house that are, like, physically comfortable. Like, blankets and seats that I feel more emotionally attached to than I should because they bring me, like, physical comfort. I'm like, maybe my favorite blanket, it actually has a face on it, it would be perfect. Then I was like, that's not useful. It would be floppy. What could it do for me? This is wrong.
But comfy things exude a personality of comfiness.
Okay, so for question three, I feel like I want to answer that question, but I have so many questions about what the powder does. Like, does it last forever? Is it a limited time? The thing that comes to life, do you get to tell it what to do, or does it have complete free will? And also, like, does it feel pain when things happen? There's so many questions.
I don't think they feel pain because the moose thing just came apart and it was fine.
But, like, thinking about it a little bit more, I probably some of my stuffed animals I would love to give the powder of life to.
Your houseplants.
They're already alive. I don't think that counts because, like, the houseplants are alive.
What about the dead plants that you also have?
No, I feel like that would just be pure suffering if you've sprinkled the powder of life on dead plants.
I guess that leads to the question of would it just animate a dead thing or would it bring it life? And it's the powder of life. So if it once lived, could it bring back the dead? Like if you sprinkled it on a dead human.
Well, they put it on the dead moose and like the moose's body didn't grow back. It's not like it grew another heart or something. It's definitely still dead. It's just animate. So I think the dead plants would still just be shrivelly dead stuff.
The Gump had a recollection of being a Gump, for what that's worth.
Yeah, the moose had memories.
Well, what about the pumpkin? The pumpkin didn't become more pumpkin-ish. It became an entirely different sentient kind of thing.
It's true. I feel like even the movie doesn't have all the answers that we need. So...
I mean, but the moose took on the body that they gave it, right? The couch had legs that moved, yeah. And...
Yeah, but did the moose feel it when the couch came apart? Because that was something else that someone mentioned. It did not give a shit at all. Even though I was like, you're losing your wings, you're losing your body. Do not feel sorrow.
Well, the bodiless heads didn't seem to feel it.
Well, it knew it was falling apart. It warned everybody.
And it did have the sense of, it's on the left side, on the right side, grab the rope.
But neither did Pumpkinhead. Pumpkinhead had limbs that were missing and broken, and he didn't really feel pain either.
I just wanted to say that the moose had a sense of ego, of self, but not really a sense of body. Like, you know, it was like, oh, I'm losing my wing. I guess that means something to you, not really to me, because I am but a mind.
Well, now we're getting into, like, Western philosophy of, like, mind-body separation, or is it all one thing?
We always get into Western philosophy of mind and body at Memory Static.
Exactly. And that is the perennial question of Return to Oz.
I'm curious as to what happened to the couch and the palm fronds once they fell out of the sky, and they were like, not in our line of vision, we don't give a shit. But it still had the powder of life.
Yeah, they're still alive.
They're alive, wandering around, lost and abandoned.
I think they died a slow and horrible death in the desert of despair.
The deadly desert was incredibly creepy. I remember it being more a part of the story than it actually was.
I think the deadly desert just made a huge impact because it's scary to... It's like hot lava, the game. The ground is lava. Except it's sand and you don't get burned, you just turn to sand.
Yeah. Bailey and Kate, does the desert resembling a children's game lend credence to the idea that this was all in her head?
That's a really good question. First of all, in the movie, there's a whole lot of foreshadowing in the exposition, which, you know, the way dreams work, you're absorbing all of the things that you're interacting with throughout the day and then building dreams around it. So it makes a lot of sense considering all of the foreshadowing. She's got the pumpkin. There's a little girl that saves her.
and also she sees her in reflections before anything else. There's also the machine with the face, and that becomes TikTok. So the Deadly Desert, I don't think, was represented at all in the beginning, but it makes sense just with her understanding of the world that she would incorporate other things just from her childish understanding of the world around her within the dream. I don't know.
And I mean, it was the turn of the century, and so deserts literally were deadly.
Very true.
You didn't wander from the water or from the sources of life.
If I had the powder of life, I would sprinkle it upon this episode of Memory Static. So that this episode might go forth upon the population of the earth and ascribe the importance of the, what year was it? 1985. The 1985 cult classic, Return to Oz. And a tribute to that film, a status of importance, if not akin to the cult classic of the 1939 Wizard of Oz, even exceeding that, so that it might perpetuate its film influence upon the community of artisan filmgoers henceforth.
I love you, Cullen.
All right, Cullen. Can you hear me?
Oh, Bailey. I just had the strangest dream.
Yes?
And you were there. And I was there. And everybody was there.
I'm sorry to break it to you. It wasn't a dream.
Oh.
Do you remember watching the movie?
I do. I do remember watching the movie. It's a bit hazy, but it's coming back to me.
And so how does that relate to your memories of watching it when you were little?
Well, you know, Bailey, the interesting thing is, upon watching it again recently, I realized that my recollections of the movie had a lot of the events displaced, totally out of order. And I'm wondering if there was some sort of, like, reverse time echo effect from the slow-moving time machine that distorted my memories of the movie before we even watched it together.
I have never heard of that being something that happens, but I'm not going to deny that that is a possibility. Just like I can't really know anything ever, really.
Well, we are in some scientifically untested waters, what with this time phenomenon.
It is true.
I guess some research still needs to be done.
What were the most prominent things that stood out to you?
Well, you know, I completely forgot that Dorothy Gale is an actual child in this movie.
You thought she was almost an adult like Judy Garland?
Yeah. I guess Judy Garland's performance in the cult classic A Wizard of Oz is so iconic that I just kind of mashed them together in my head. But that said, I thought the actress who played Dorothy in Return to Oz was actually really good, especially considering how young she was.
Mm-hmm. You had specifically mentioned to me at the party that you wanted to talk about the music comparisons between the two movies.
Yeah, I do. So, first of all, the original Wizard of Oz, the cult classic, was 1939, yeah? Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And then this new movie, The Return to Oz, is 1985. And that difference in time is definitely audible in the score. And probably the most significant difference is that Return to Oz is not a musical. The original Wizard of Oz cult classic had this really pure, dreamlike score with all these captivating melodies. And that's not present in The Return to Oz. But that's intentional, I think, because it also has a much eerier backing track, in my opinion, which is something that matches the overall tone of the movie, evoking this distorted version of the Land of Oz. Lots of octatonic scales and ambient stuff. It really sets the mood for the entire piece. It wouldn't be the same movie if it had, you know, bright, happy-go-lucky numbers like, I don't know, If I Only Had a Soul.
Well, I guess, like, the most important thing that I want to know is, did you enjoy it? Or were you still as disappointed as you were the first time you watched it?
Oh, no, I thought it was great. I loved it. And for the record, I thought I would enjoy it going in. For people who are fans of films from the 80s, this is a film from the 80s.
Yeah.
I can totally understand why people would think that the Wheelers are the scariest part of the movie. For some reason, they didn't really scare me at all when I was a child, but watching it again, I understand it.
Interesting. So are you feeling better than last Saturday?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I'm still reorienting myself, but I think I'm feeling like 92% better.
I guess the slow-moving time machine is not for you.
Yeah, I think I'll be sticking with my own time for now.
Maybe that's a good idea. All right, so we're going to hop back over to the party and say goodbye with everybody else.
We're going to wrap it up. Thank you so much, everybody, that made it to our first experimental, socially distanced, pandemic time film screening in the backyard. This has been Memory Static. Return your videos here!
Yet to dry, I turn the the power I lack to remember the words. The bricks all have crumbled, the road there is gone. Without a way back, I can only move on.
Memory Static is produced and edited by me, Bailey Moore. Original music is by me and my brother Cullen Moore, also known as Plaid Tuxedo. You can find more of his music on YouTube or by visiting his website at plaidtuxedo.com. Thank you to Cullen for being this episode's special guest. Thank you to all the Static Party guests, and thank you at home for listening. A special thanks goes out to our new members on Patreon, Jaime Perez and Kathy Moore. Thank you so much for supporting the podcast. If you have any stories about any of the questions asked on these episodes, or have a movie you'd like us to cover, email us at memorystatic@gmail.com. And if you are enjoying the show, please consider rating and reviewing the podcast and supporting us on Patreon. Every little bit helps keep this going. We've got one more episode to round out the second season, so I'll be visiting your ears again really soon. Bye for now.